infant echoing in my ears. In the ground? She must be so cold. I started to rise, as if to go to her, but Alexander pulled me back into his arms. No, my love. She's with her creator now. Icy tears trailed upon my face. She never felt me hold her. She must have been frightened and alone. You held her, he whispered. You held her inside your body. She wasn't frightened, my angel. Not while she felt the strength of your love, and you must believe me, for who knows the strength of that love better than I do? Having never lost a child before, I couldn't fathom the grief, or that I would feel anything other than grief ever again. I feel shattered, broken in pieces. I'll hold you together, he said, making a bed for me of his whole body. For once, let me hold you together. I let him rock me as I whispered my most secret fears. I took this child for an embodiment of grace and love and forgiveness, and now she's gone. What if this is the end of us? This is not the end of us, Alexander said, taking my face in his hands. I have tendered my resignation to the president. I am yours forever, Eliza, and I will never leave you alone or desperate again. I will not let this be the end of us. This is the beginning. Chapter 26. You may judge how much Hamilton must be mortified at his loss of influence, such that he would descend to the language of a street bully. Edward Livingston to his mother. Summer 1795, New York City. Flowers. In the 5 months since he'd left the government, my husband filled my world with flowers. Cut hothouse hyacinths in winter, sunny daffodils from Mama's garden during our visits to the pastures, azaleas at the Pinkster Festival, and now the riot of purple aster, red roses, and orange lilies of New York's Vauxhall Gardens, where we strolled with our children. "Buy your sister's ice cream," Alexander called after Philip, while balancing 3-year-old Johnny on his shoulders. Running wild amongst the gravel paths between the flowers and sculpted shrubbery, our children were happy to have returned to New York. And I was, too. Some part of me would always long for the countryside, but my husband's legal trade was a city occupation, and there could be no better city than this one. To me, New York City was a more hopeful, energetic place than Philadelphia. Certainly, I felt better here. The riverside walks and musical concerts and frenetic pace had been a balm for and a distraction from my grief over our lost child. I was not, of course, the first woman to lose a baby. My mother and my sisters had endured the same. But I'd lived so blessed an existence that it was, to that point, the worst pain of my life. And through it, Alexander had held me together, just as he promised. He'd let me rage, he'd let me cry, he'd let me question even the mercy of God. And it was through my husband's unfailing strength that I forgave myself for having ever worried that another child would be too much burden. When I save enough money, I'll build you a country house with a flower garden all your own, he promised, with room for all the children and more besides, if God should see fit to bless us with more. Meanwhile, I found contentment with what we had. And now, watching my husband spread a picnic blanket beneath the shade of a statue near the orchestra pit, I felt like a cat purring in a warm patch of sun. I unpacked our basket as the musicians tuned their instruments with Yankee Doodle, and I marveled at how well Alexander carried his 40 years. Though his auburn hair had gone silver at the temples, and his nose seemed a bit sharper, my husband was still handsome and distinguished, and mine in a way he'd never been before. Is there something wrong, my angel? Nothing at all, I answered, tearing off a chunk of bread for Johnny. In this moment, I feel as if there is nothing whatsoever wrong in the world.
Then I'm doubly sorry to tell you that your boy is about to topple that wax figure of a Roman general,
said a familiar voice, and we looked up to see the wryly amused visage of Aaron Burr. Sipping at a lemon ice, Burr accompanied his polite 12-year-old daughter, Theodosia, who took so much after her mother that it allayed some of the wariness her father's presence unleashed in me.
James! My husband shouted after our 8-year-old troublemaker,
while Burr and his daughter settled onto a blanket beside us to wait for the sun to set and the fireworks to begin. Welcome home, Senator, I said, determined to keep the conversation friendly. Burr nodded in polite acknowledgement. Having returned recently from a special session of Congress in Philadelphia, where he'd done his utmost to undermine President Washington and everything my husband had put into motion. At least Washington remained to defend the Federalist cause. When we'd said our farewells to the Washingtons, my husband, with true respect and affectionate attachment, me with a teary and grateful embrace for Martha and one of awe for the great man, I knew the president's continuance in office was the one thing that allowed Alexander to retire, the reason he could be here with us now. We remained on cordial terms with Burr, if only because he still worked with the Manumission Society to help free blacks from being snatched up on the streets and sold back into slavery in the southern states. Still, I couldn't keep myself from twitting him. I'm afraid we missed you at the dinner in honor of my husband, hosted by the Chamber of Commerce.
Ah, well, yes, I was sorry to miss it.
Burr managed, clearly attempting to play nice as well, though we all knew he'd have been pilloried by his own political party if he'd attended. The merchants of the city had given Alexander a hero's welcome, celebrating us with champagne, a feast, and a ball. Well-wishers pressed into the overcrowded ballroom to listen to my husband's mercifully short remarks on the virtues of the city's businessmen. And they'd cheered 3 times for Washington, 3 times for Adams, and 9 times for Alexander Hamilton. However vilified my husband might have been in Philadelphia, he was still New York's favorite son, and I was quite sure Burr took my meaning. Clearing his throat, he changed the subject.
I hear your law practice is thriving, Hamilton.
I'm kept quite busy, thank you, Alexander replied, and he wasn't boasting.
After a few months of riding and fishing and hunting with my father and our sons upstate, Alexander had decided that vacations disagreed with him entirely. In fact, he blamed this leisurely sojourn for the loss of his bank account book, which mortified him since he'd created the bank that issued it. He'd since become convinced that he might lose his faculties altogether if he let them rest. So he'd thrown himself into the enterprise of paying off our debts and rebuilding our fortune.
It's a good strategy, Burr said, sipping the last of his lemon ice.
What is?
Alexander asked. Burr stretched upon his checkered blanket.
Temporary retreat from the political arena. Retirement is very fashionable these days amongst men who wish to be president.
How relieved I was to hear Alexander laugh.
That's Jefferson's game. As for me, I'm about the care of my family now. Congratulate me, friend, for I am no longer a public man. Exactly what a man would say if he wanted to be president,
Burr replied.
You're wise to let John Jay take the blame for this treaty of amity, commerce, and navigation he's forged with the British, then sweep in after it passes in Congress and reap the benefits.
Almost in spite of himself, Alexander asked,
You think the treaty will pass?
Perhaps, Burr said, but I can't vote for it. Not if I want to remain a senator. It's too unpopular.
Sensing a coming debate, I said, Gentlemen, I beg you not to spoil the evening. Reluctantly, they obliged me, and a lovely time was had by all. Philip, Anna, Fanny, and Theodosia, all 4 of them close in age,
shared ice cream upon a blanket, and stared up in marvel at the fireworks overhead. And nestled against Alexander's side, I felt happy as I hadn't felt in years. Which was why, I think, I was so vexed the next evening to find Alexander pacing in the airy entryway of our rented townhouse on Broadway. There's a French flag flying atop the Tontine Coffee House. "A French flag over the Tontine?" I asked in mock outrage. "Well, then, henceforth we shall take our coffee elsewhere." Which would be a trial, since I loved the Tontine. Alexander, however, was not to be mollified. "A French flag hoisted blocks from my door. Next, I suppose, it will fly over the city instead of our stars and stripes."
"I'm sure it is only a protest against Great Britain. If we must choose a side in the European war, the people would choose our first ally, France."
"We mustn't choose any side," Alexander said, wearing a hole in the floor by the window. "It's not our war. Even if it was, we can't win another war. We can't afford it. And war would prevent the Tontine from selling their coffee, the fools."
Giving him a peck upon the cheek, I said, "Fortunately, it's no longer your worry." We had plans for the theater, after all, and it was time to dress. Now that he'd returned to private practice, we could afford new clothes, and I was eager to see him in his new double-breasted white waistcoat and dark breeches, worn loosely, as was now the fashion. But he continued to pace like an angry lion.
"To see the character of our government sported with tortures my heart."
"I know, my love," I said, patiently guiding him toward the stairs. He took two steps before stopping again.
"Am I more of an American than those who drew their first breath on American ground? How can everyone else view this so calmly?"
As someone who drew first breath upon American ground, I defended myself. "I don't view it calmly, but you cannot keep writing treatises for the president as if he were still in the cabinet." He scowled. But since our marriage was now on a more equal footing, I dared to scowl back. "Oh, did you think you fooled me into believing the scribbling you've been doing late at night was for some legal case?" For a moment, his eyes blazed with indignation, as if he meant to deny it. Then his bravado gave out.
"You think I'm a fool. A romantic Don Quixote tilting at windmills."
"I think you've already accomplished everything you set out to do." It was not flattery. He'd fought and won a war and built a federal government. He'd created a coast guard, a national bank, and invented a scheme of taxation that held the states together. He'd founded a political party, smashed a rebellion, and put in motion a financial system that was providing prosperity for nearly everyone. In short, Alexander Hamilton was a greater man than the country deserved, and I wasn't enough of a patriot to willingly give him back. Especially not when I saw what my countrymen were doing to poor John Jay. There was not a street corner one could pass without hearing some raving Jacobin denouncing the man for his controversial treaty, which anti-federalists feared prioritized closer economic and political ties with the British monarchy over support for French republicanism and therefore repudiated American values.
"Damn John Jay. Damn everyone that won't damn John Jay. Damn everyone that won't put up lights in the windows and sit up all night damning John Jay."
After the treaty was signed, Jay was, as he told us himself, burned in effigy in so many cities that he could have traveled the country at night with nothing to guide him but the light of his own flaming form. My poor cousin Sarah Livingston Jay had reason to fear leaving the house. And this could have been our fate, I knew. My husband had narrowly missed being sent to negotiate in Jay's place, had already resisted an attempt to make him a chief justice, and was daily forced to dismiss rumors that he should be thrown in to be the next president of the United States. So I was unspeakably grateful that my husband no longer held any office. And yet he was still giving speeches. Which was how,
While I sat trying to mend a pair of Philip's shoes he'd outgrown, my now nearly 14-year-old son came to ask, "Can I go watch Father speak in favor of the Jay Treaty?" Quite against the idea, I said, "Your father isn't likely to say anything that you haven't already heard at the supper table, and I dislike for you to be by yourself in a crowd." Philip made a sound of exasperation. At my age, my father was his own man, in command of a trading firm.
"Your father was an abandoned boy trying to make his way in the world with any job he could get."
This is what I wanted to say. But Alexander never wanted his children to know the scars of his youth. He only ever wanted them to see him as heroic. And I wanted them to see him that way, too. Especially Philip. So, if my son wanted to see his father give a speech, I could scarcely deny him. Besides, it was only a 5-minute walk to Federal Hall from our new lodgings.
"We'll go together. There's a new shoemaker near Wall Street," I said, giving up on mending the old leather. "If we leave now, we'll be in time to see your father's speech on the way back."
When Philip grinned beneath the down of a burgeoning mustache upon his lip, I added, "Now change clothes so you look like the fine young gentleman you're becoming instead of an urchin." While my eldest donned his best shirt, I found my straw bonnet with its white ribbon, and leaving the younger children with our newly hired governess, we were off. It was a fine, clear summer day, and I was astonished at the size of the crowd. Thousands packed into the square. Not just dock workers in knit caps and young toughs in homespun jackets, but the better sort of people, too, including ladies with colorful lace parasols and gentlemen in top hats from the finest families. There, too, upon a stoop near our old house, stood my husband, surrounded by half a dozen impeccably dressed Federalist lawyers like Robert Troop and Nicholas Fish. It was nearly impossible to push closer given the throng, but at the toll of the clock bell, my husband's voice boomed out to ask who had convened the assembly. And that's when I first realized that Alexander hadn't so much as come to give a speech as to stop one. The gathering was for the apparent purpose of condemning the Jay Treaty, and my husband wasn't about to let it happen. "By what right does Livingston speak before me?" Almost as a rebuke, a quick, spontaneous vote determined that Livingston should speak first. But I stood agape as the rest of the crowd began to heckle. There, on the same hallowed ground where we'd once gathered to watch George Washington take his solemn oath of office, erstwhile respectable members of the business community shouted down the hapless Mr. Livingston, who, now red-faced, suggested a new meeting place where he could be heard.
"Come, then, all foes of this cowardly treaty, away to Trinity Church."
It seemed to me a very wise idea to break up what was swiftly becoming a mob, and I myself searched for some avenue of retreat, prodding my boy up onto the sidewalk in the shade of a buttonwood tree. All the while, my husband was shouting,
"There is the necessity of a full discussion before citizens should make up their minds about this treaty."
As the former Secretary of the Treasury, he was used to being obeyed. But this time, he was treated to a chorus of hoots and hisses. My husband's Federalists had shouted down Livingston, but now the Republicans, slowly but surely coalescing into a party of their own thanks to this treaty, returned the favor, insensible to my husband's demand to be heard. My son was appalled.
"The rascals!"
A gentleman in riding boots clapped Philip on the back, perhaps recognizing him as his father's son. Meanwhile, to my right, a bearded man in a beaver cap stooped to pull a loose cobble from the street.
"Not again," I thought,
prodding Philip toward the fence encircling the nearest yard. I'd been witness to too much disorder in my life not to recognize the danger. "We're going." I'd learned, after hard experience, to head for the edges, moving diagonally against the crowd. but I didn't get very far before the man with the cobblestone pulled his arm back and launched it. After that was pandemonium.
"Anglo man! Corrupt Tory!"
they shouted at my husband. Alexander shouted back, with pugnacious bombast, calling them wicked Jacobins.
"Liberté, égalité, fraternité," say the French you admire. But what patriot could ally with those who executed the kinswomen of our own imprisoned General Lafayette?
To those words he was greeted with a hailstorm of bricks and stones, and I watched in horror as my husband staggered, fell, and disappeared into the crowd. I couldn't see him. I couldn't see anything over the blur of heads and shoulders. Philip broke away from me, rushing to his father's defense, elbowing his way into a knot of red-faced, meat-fisted men. "Philip!" I cried, trying to stop him, pushing forward past a brine-scented sailor and shoving a carpenter with sawdust on his apron. "Philip!" I couldn't have been more than 20 feet from the furious men, close enough to see Alexander pop up out of the sea of people, holding his head with one hand even as he spat contemptuous laughter.
"Well, if you use such knockabout arguments, I must retire."
Almost comically, my husband bowed and ducked away while the crowd broke apart, some following the Livingstons to Trinity Church, some marching to the Battery, where they promised to burn the treaty and presumably another effigy of Jay. "Dear God," I said, reaching my husband's side, not knowing whether I should tend his head or give it another thump. "What in the name of prudence could you—"
"It only grazed me,"
my husband said, wiping blood away with his now torn sleeve. Meanwhile, my son shouted after the retreating assailants.
"No doubt you want to knock out my father's brains. It's the only way you blockheads could ever win an argument with him."
"Philip!" Having barked his name in a fashion so like my mother that I was secretly appalled, I then rounded on my husband, hissing, "Fine things you teach your son!" Hamilton had no reply to that. Fetching his now dusty black hat from the ground and straightening his coat, he made ready to walk us home, a number of his friends following us down the block, making me feel less that he was the head of a political party and more that he led a street gang. More and more, I wondered if there was much difference between the two. We'd only gone a little way before coming upon some lawyers in an altercation on Wall Street.
"Gentlemen," Alexander said, stepping between them, "why don't we resolve this matter between us at France's over some glasses of brandy?"
Now this was more in keeping with the conduct I expected, but Alexander said,
"Philip, I bid you escort your mother home."
As I was in high dudgeon with both of them, I exclaimed, "By no means. Stay with your father and make no more mischief." "Either of you," my eyes said. And with that, I returned home, grateful that my husband had escaped his latest brush with the mob with no more than a scrape on the head. That evening, he said he counted it a price worth paying for having disrupted the protest. But 4 days later, I was to learn just how high a price he'd been willing to pay. "Kitty," I said, startled to find my one-time companion upon my doorstep, wearing a broad-brimmed black hat and clutching a black lace parasol. We'd not spoken a word in the 6 years since the inaugural ball, and the feud between the Livingston family and mine had only worsened since then. Still, I found myself glad to see her, especially since I knew she'd recently been widowed. "Please, come in." She gave a delicate shake of her head. "I should rather, well, I would prefer if we spoke in your garden." This was becoming curiouser by the moment. Nodding, I led her to my herb garden. "I was so sorry to learn of your husband's passing." She self-consciously smoothed the bodice of her widow's weeds. "Thank you. Amongst many other sorrows, I'm afraid widowhood has deprived me of fashion. Do you find me much changed?" "You look just the same," I said, though black did not flatter her, and her skin no longer glowed.
I didn't realize you'd return to New York. Are you visiting?
I'm here to stay. I'm to be married again in the coming year to my cousin, John Livingston.
Another Livingston, of course.
I congratulate you. Thank you, she said brusquely. But I've come on a matter of more interest to you. Namely, to speak about the man you married. You see, I'm of the opinion that Hamilton is trying to get himself killed.
I'd stooped to pluck some flowers for the dinner table, but now stood up abruptly.
Kitty, just because a man expresses an opinion, even an unpopular one, doesn't justify your family's faction stoning him in the street.
Kitty's lips thinned.
I'm not speaking of the mayhem at Federal Hall. It's what happened afterward that has forced me to deliver a warning. Your husband is embroiled in an affair of honor. Two, actually.
Affairs of honor. That meant my husband had either challenged or been challenged to a duel. Two of them, if Kitty was to be believed. But I stiffened because experience had taught me not to believe anything from the unholy Jefferson-Livingston-Clinton alliance.
With who?
With my cousin, for one. I know you may not be disposed to believe me, but I heard it from your own husband's mouth when we crossed paths outside his law office.
Now I definitely didn't believe her. My husband told you he was going to duel with a Livingston, I asked dubiously.
Men didn't tell women such things. It wasn't gentlemanly. It would cause alarm in a man's family, and that family might persuade a man to forego pistols, thereby risking his honor.
Hamilton pretended to let it slip, Kitty said with a fleeting smirk. I still remember perfectly well what he's like when he wants something. And in this case, he wanted me to warn my cousin's wife that he'd shoot her husband dead unless she put a stop to it.
Kitty's smirk now became more than fleeting.
So I thought to myself, turnabout is fair play, which is why I'm warning you.
I sobered as my doubts were swiftly replaced with the cool chill of dread.
Fair play.
Dueling is not a game, Kitty.
Tell that to your husband, Kitty replied. Because after leaving Federal Hall on Saturday, he not only embroiled himself in two affairs of honor in the space of an hour, he'd also thrown up his arms and declared himself ready to fight my family's whole detestable faction one by one.
The heat of shame it brought to my cheeks to imagine my husband stooping to the level of a street brawler. He, who'd been George Washington's Secretary of the Treasury. But of course, now he was not. And maybe he didn't know what he was anymore, if not that.
Are you mad? I asked Alexander. I had accosted him in the carriage house, where the heat gave rise to the scent of horse. And though my husband preferred that we have the conversation inside, I didn't want to give him time to formulate a jury argument.
Aren't you the same man who toiled to make this country a nation of laws? Yet you retort to threats of duels and fisticuffs. And in front of Philip, it's barbarism.
He gave a little sigh.
It won't come to a duel.
Remembering that Angelica's husband had been all but exiled from England for having nearly killed a man in a duel, I asked,
How can you be certain?
Because I've been involved in affairs of honor several times before without a shot ever being fired.
This staggering bit of news I'd scarcely digested before he continued.
I manage them to my satisfaction and my opponents withdraw, which is why I tipped my hand to Kitty.
So you did tell her?
Given the color that darkened his cheeks, this embarrassed him, but not enough.
What an incurable schemer.
I expected Kitty to warn the women folk of her family, who would, in turn, exert pressure upon Livingston to come to terms with me. I never predicted she'd take license to alarm you.
Well, as always, you are too clever by half.
Eliza, this is the way of honor with gentlemen.
If it's honor that you value, then perhaps you ought to guard the esteem your country still has for you, by not offering to brawl in the streets like a madman.
I am not mad.
No, I asked, thinking his behavior erratic. To prove it, I held up three different scribblings I'd found on his desk. What do I see here? An essay in defense of the Jay Treaty that you wrote for the papers under one pen name. A second, written under a different name, in which you anonymously praise yourself for writing the first, and then a raving third pretending to add to the imaginary choir. It's madness.
I am not mad, he repeated, kicking at a bit of straw on the floor.
Then what in blazes is wrong with you? Because issuing the challenges, threatening fistfights, breaking up protests, and throwing yourself into Gazette debates with such duplicity, all of this seems as if you're half out of your mind.
I am out of my mind,
he suddenly shouted, and then he pressed his fist to his mouth, his eyes going shockingly glassy.
I lost a child, Eliza, he choked out. I lost a child, too.
He threw down the leather satchel he carried with him nearly everywhere, and sank down onto a bale of hay. He stayed there, silent, as I nearly quaked at the revelation. He'd lost a child. Of course he had. But consumed in a mother's grief, I'd thought only of the fact that I had lost a child. I will hold you together, he'd promised in the darkest hour. He'd done that with tenderness, patience, and devotion. But he'd suppressed his own grief so long that now he was the one flying to pieces. And I'd neither seen the cracks forming nor done anything to heal them. Oh, Alexander, I said, going to his side and realizing he always kept something of himself hidden from everyone. Even in the grips of yellow fever, thinking he was soon to die, he'd been unable to reveal himself completely. He was not the sort of man to accept pity, not the sort of man to give himself over to a woman. But I wrapped my arms around him anyway. Let me hold you together now. Let us both hold each other together from now on. Alexander took a great shuddering breath.
What would you have me do? I should let them call me a coward. Let them accuse me there in the street of treason, of stealing from the treasury with the connivance of Britain. Is that what you want me to do?
I want you to remember that you're a father, and that you promised never to leave me alone or desperate again. He was quiet a long time, but then he nodded.
And a promise must never be broken.
In the end, one man was persuaded to deny casting aspersions on my husband's manhood. The other was persuaded to issue a lukewarm apology. My husband was persuaded to say that he was satisfied. And I was persuaded I would never again hear another word about duels. Chapter 27 October 1795, New York City. The scrap of paper in my husband's coat pocket smelled of French lavender, and upon it, in a very fine feminine hand, was written a street address. Just days ago, Alexander warned that Maria Reynolds had returned to New York. He didn't want me to be dismayed if our paths should cross. But now I was left to wonder how he knew of her return, and if this was her address. I should ask him, I thought. Or perhaps I should throw this scrap of paper in the fire. To investigate would be beneath my dignity. I shouldn't elevate my suspicions by crossing town to learn who resided at this address. But in the end, that's just what I did. Because I couldn't live with myself if I was again a trusting fool. Dressed in my finest gown, I climbed the crumbling steps, took hold of the knocker, and rapped firmly on the door. Bracing for the pain. If this was the residence of my husband's mistress, I didn't know what I'd say or do. I only knew that I must know. The door opened, and the sight of him, the shock of it, nearly stopped my heart.
It wasn't my husband, but a stranger. And yet I knew that face. The length of it, the nobility of his form, that ridiculous martial pose.
"Bonjour," he said, as ruddy autumn leaves swirled at my feet. "You're here to see Monsieur La Colombe."
Under no circumstances would I pay call to a gentleman's home by myself, in the middle of the day, as if in assignation. So I ignored his question in favor of my own. "Who might you be?" Perhaps it was the directness of my scrutiny that made the youth's eyes dart away. I could see now that he was a boy, perhaps 16, 17, no more than that.
"A servant," he said.
What a dreadful liar, because his voice convinced me that my eyes were not playing me false, that I knew who this was. "I am Mrs. Alexander Hamilton," I said at once. Upon hearing my name, the panicked boy motioned me swiftly into the house. "Venez vite! Come in, s'il vous plaît!" Only when the door closed did he give a courtly bow with a flourish that again reminded me of his father.
"Pardon, madame. Forgive the ruse. My name is George Washington Louis Gilbert du
Mathieu," I finished for him, sudden affection gripping me. "Yes, I knew your father, and you will have trouble convincing anyone that you're a servant, for you are every inch Lafayette's son." His smile filled with pride, but also confusion.
"Colonel Hamilton sent you?"
"No, I'm afraid our meeting is quite a surprise to me, and a relief as well. For the secret my husband was keeping, I realized now, had nothing to do with that woman. How have you come to be in New York?"
"My mother sent me. She was spared from the guillotine, thanks to Ambassador Monroe."
President Washington had sent Monroe to be our minister to France, and my husband insisted he was bungling the job. But James Monroe had accomplished this, for which I was deeply grateful. "Is she here? Is your mother free?" The boy shook his head.
"Maman insisted upon joining my father in his prison cell, to shame his captors or share his fate. But she made me go,"
George said, eyes welling with guilt-ridden tears.
"I did not want to leave them behind, but she said I could save their lives. I am to go for help, to the American president himself."
I nodded quickly. "We must get you to Philadelphia."
"Colonel Hamilton says it is not yet possible."
Not yet possible? I couldn't imagine what intrigue my husband was about, or why Lafayette's son was posing as a servant. But my heart broke at the boy's obvious terror. "Then you must come home with me." Young George shook his head.
"It is not safe."
I didn't care. I'd protested my husband threatening to brawl in the streets over a matter of a treaty, but if risks must be taken, then they must be taken for the son of a man we both loved. "I insist," I said, pained to see how thin George was, and appalled at the shabby brown coat in which he'd been clothed. I'd have to find him new breeches and an embroidered coat, something fitting. "I'll make you a fine meal." Though hunger lurked in his eyes, he fretted.
"But my tutor and our host..."
"They're both welcome," I said. With that, I took Georges home straight away in my carriage, though the boy insisted upon using the servant's door in the back. He feared he was being hunted, that there were spies in the city, that the Jacobins and their supporters were here in New York. Would such men kidnap young Lafayette and return him to bloody France?
"Almost assuredly," my husband said when he returned home to find Georges already fast friends with our Philip.
The two youths ate heaps of cold mutton and buttered bread while falling into easy conversation at the table. They made a handsome pair, Lafayette's red-headed son and Hamilton's brown-haired boy. After supper, Georges complimented Anna on her songs, saying she might one day sing at the opera house in Paris. And my delighted girl blushed with pleasure from head to toe. Why can't young Lafayette see the president? I whispered as we watched from across the hall. My husband grimaced.
Because the French ambassador is refusing to attend Washington's levees on account of the presence of exiles like Noailles. Jefferson tried to argue that these are public functions and anyone is welcome, but the new French government won't listen even to him. If the ambassador sees Lafayette's son in Washington's presence, they might demand we return the boy to France.
Those murderous animals can't have him,
I hissed.
That was something over which I would be prepared to stand and fight. And Alexander rubbed at the small of my back to calm me.
They may argue the president is violating our neutrality by harboring the son of a French traitor.
Lafayette is no traitor.
Alexander hushed me. Believe me, my love, it afflicts me with as much indignation as you, which is why I've been acting the part of a secret go-between. The president wants to embrace young Lafayette, but cannot take the lad in. Not yet.
Then we must. Unexpectedly, my husband wandered away from me, down into the kitchen. I found him with both hands upon the butcher block, his head hung low. Alexander, if the president cannot shelter Lafayette's son for fear of offending the French, we can, we should, we must. And when I think of how you must have felt when you were his age, coming to this city alone.
Alexander sighed, staring up at me. Here you are, ready to open your arms to another desperate child for my sake. And this, after I've done so much injury to your faith in me, that you'd cross town with a scrap of paper to verify my fidelity.
So he knew what I'd done.
Why I'd gone to an unknown address.
And I was filled with shame, wondering what sort of weapon infidelity was, that it should repeatedly cut both its perpetrator and its victim, long after they'd forgiven one another.
I am sorry.
With generosity, he waved away my apology. You're merely testing the ground with your foot to make sure it's solid. He left unspoken the question, but will you ever be sure of me? No wonder marriage required a vow before God and witnesses. It was no easy thing, and yet the struggles somehow made me cherish it more. Made me cherish him more. Made me cherish, too, that we could offer a home to Lafayette's son. And not only for my husband's sake. If the worst should ever come to pass in our country, I might be forced to send my own children across the sea to safety. I saw in Georges both the untrusting boy my husband had been, and my own son, if the Jacobins had their way. And it made me feel like the protective lioness I'd vowed to be. I didn't know Lafayette's wife, but we were both married to revolutionaries, and we were both mothers. So I was determined to take care of her hunted son no matter what.
The president will not stand for re-election, Alexander announced as he guided me into his law office.
We were supposed to be on the way to a dinner party to be held in the home of his new law partner, Nathaniel Pendleton, and we were both dressed very grandly for the occasion, but he'd insisted we needed to stop to retrieve some papers.
My stomach dropped.
Not at the news, for I think I remain one of two people in the entire nation who was not surprised, the other being Martha Washington.
No.
My foreboding stemmed from knowing that Washington's presence at the helm of the government was what allowed Alexander to retire. After 6 long months, we'd finally sent Georges off with our love and best wishes to be received by President Washington. The boy was so studious, helpful, and sensible that it left us both a little bereft to part with him. But I'd also been hopeful that it was the last political crisis in which we'd be embroiled. Now, I feared to be embroiled in another. Absent-mindedly shoving teetering stacks of books and papers out of his way, Alexander was despondent.
President Washington says he can no longer endure to be devoured in the prints by a set of infamous scribblers. Who can blame him? I asked, taking note that one whole shelf of the wall-length bookcase behind Alexander had been devoted to storing the latest gazettes. No one wanted to serve any more. Not when, under our new government, any man, whether a gentleman or a scoundrel, could say whatever he pleased and print whatever libels he wished without consequence. And the ignorant populace, spewing tobacco juice as they ranted, took full advantage. As if the notion that all men were created equal somehow meant that one need not aspire to knowledge and ability. All distinctions of class, breeding, or merit discarded, all notions of civility deserted. Months ago, the president had persuaded James McHenry, Hamilton's old friend and fellow aide-de-camp, to serve as Secretary of War. And Mac couldn't find it within himself to disappoint his old general. But six of the most talented men in America had turned down the post of Secretary of State, simply because the irrational calumny heaped upon the heads of public officials was so calculated and unrelenting as to put a man and his family in fear for their lives. The distrust and hatred of anyone who attempted to govern for the benefit of society could drive lesser men than my husband to their knees. And it had once driven my husband there, too. "Who will replace President Washington?" I asked, as I took one of the facing seats, more than a little wary that my husband might feel compelled to put himself forward. I'd sipped from the cup of glory and found the taste bitter. So I was grateful when he answered, "By seniority, John Adams is the heir apparent. But lacking Washington's majesty, popularity, and wartime experience, Adams is no fit replacement. Personally, I have always thought his temper too high and unhinged. Still, all reservations must give way to the great object of keeping Jefferson from the presidency." The Virginian had bided his time in retirement and become the leader of a genuine political party. They called themselves Republicans, a name that offensively implied the present government was comprised of monarchists. But we still called them Jacobins, since they seemed to have so much in common with the terrorists who controlled France. They could not be allowed to come to power here. Still, I nearly shook with relief that my husband wouldn't be the man to oppose them. "Let it be John Adams, then," I said. Alexander puffed out a snort of disgust, so I continued. "Washington's retirement is the most eloquent answer any man could ever give to those who paint him a monarchist. Someone else must now take the helm. Alexander, if you have faith in a republic where no man is king, then let it be tried." Alexander took very little on faith. Certainly not this republic. He'd never liked the ugly, misshapen compromise that had come out of the Constitutional Convention. But no man had fought harder to bring forth a government from that parchment. And perhaps no man knew better how difficult it was to bring such a government into being, or how easily it could all collapse. Sullenly, he said, "In any case, there is no persuading Washington against it. He's always been slow to take his ground, but once decided he cannot be shaken, and he's determined to leave the presidency." I reached across his desk to him. "Then you mustn't make it any more difficult for him by standing as an obstacle. Besides, John Adams was instrumental in bringing about our independence, and has been the vice president all these years. That's experience no one else has. He isn't Washington, but no one is. And that doesn't mean he can't succeed." Alexander sighed and wound his fingers with mine.
"Were you always such a wise woman?"
I sputtered, "Certainly not. I've had to become wiser to better fulfill the peculiar duties associated with being the wife of Alexander Hamilton." A spark of familiar mischief worked its way into his visage.
"Very well, wife of Alexander Hamilton."
He tugged me around to him.
"I shall now call upon you to perform one of those peculiar duties."
Scandalized, I gasped. "Not in your office."
Oh, but I insist. He stood and put me into his chair. I burned with curiosity, having no earthly idea what he might intend. Then my cheeks burned hotter when he withdrew some papers from the secret compartment of his desk and confided an entirely innocent purpose.
The president has asked me to help draft a farewell address.
Is there no one else capable? I asked, wondering if Alexander might ever be left to enjoy retirement.
Madison made an attempt, he replied, unable to utter the name of his old friend without scorn. He is, after all, the one who drafted Washington's inaugural, but as this is Washington's last address, the president won't allow the Republicans to put their stamp on it.
And Madison was a founding member of the new party that stood opposed to the Federalists in all things. Our one-time friend Monroe, too. Both of them Jefferson's protégés. All of them now aligned in favor of a weak federal government and stronger states' rights. The very things against which we'd fought for the past 15 years. So I understood, then. The president's very last address was a sacred duty. My husband explained,
"The president has asked me to take his own sentiments and ideas and remove any egotism or partisan sentiments liable to bring criticism. To put it all in a plain, simple style."
Alexander threw the papers onto the desk.
"You see my difficulty."
I chuckled because I did. I could think of no man less suited than my husband to write in a plain, simple style, without partisan warmth or egotism. Alexander brought the thunder of rhetorical cannons, not the soft refrains of conciliatory prose. But since he couldn't refuse, I tried to bolster his spirits. "You wrote for Washington as his aide-de-camp. Surely you remember how. And if you don't, consider it a stretch of your talents. You say Jimmy Madison drafted the inaugural. Well, if he had the first words, I know you'll want to have the last."
He laughed. "You saucy wench. This brings me to your part."
Alexander leaned forward so that his hands were on both arms of the chair, seductively caging me in.
"My dear Eliza, you must be what Molière's nurse was to him."
"Who?" I asked, a little wary that this might turn into another story of some ancient.
Instead, he said, "Never mind. The point is that I must test my words against your good sense."
My mouth went dry, for I didn't know whether to be flattered or terrified. Both, I decided, given what he was asking. "You cannot mean this seriously."
"I trust no one else. I trust your understanding of people, your goodness and impartial heart."
"My heart is not even slightly impartial," I said.
That made him smile. "But you're fair-minded. How often have you argued with me over the malice I've ascribed to others when simpler explanations would do? I need you to argue with me now."
He was serious. "Have you forgotten we are on our way to Pendleton's dinner party?"
"I've forgotten it entirely," he said, rising up again to find a pen. "I'll send a clerk to Fonce's Tavern for victuals to sustain us, and we'll stay here until the candles burn out."
There was a hint of familiar conspiratorial excitement in his voice now, but I reminded him with a great deal of hauteur. "As delightful as that sounds, I am in a rare state." My gauzy evening gown might have been thought scandalous in any other era, but it was the age of undress. The fashion was now all empire waistlines and sheer fabrics a la Grec, which would have left me feeling naked without gloves and shawl. "I am dressed to be seen in society, sir." With the tip of his quill pen, he flicked my flimsy shawl to the floor.
"And now you are not."
He gave his most irresistible smile.
"Your country needs you. I need you. You are my good genius of that kind which the ancient philosophers called a familiar." His eyebrows nearly waggled. "And you know that I am glad to be in every way as familiar as possible with you."
Smitten by his flirtation, I gave a helpless shrug. Oh, well, for the country, then. I forgot about the dinner party. I forgot everything but the familiar thrill of matching minds with the man I married. Not that line, I remember telling him. That business about the ignorance of facts and malicious falsehoods will be taken harshly.
That's the president's line, not mine, Alexander protested.
Nevertheless, it portrays him as a partisan in the mud, I argued. And our debate went well into the night. In truth, it went on for days, as Alexander worked on the address, scribbling words and crossing them out. Eventually, he removed the line to which I objected, that and many others, taking into consideration my suggestions, leaving me awed with the magnitude of the masterpiece. I knew, even then, that the farewell address was a moving and worthy tribute to the United States and its people, a plea for unity, a statement of purpose and guidance for the nation George Washington helped bring into being. And because of Alexander Hamilton, I had the great and everlasting fortune to be a part of its shaping. Chapter 28. May the present coolness between France and America produce, like the quarrels of lovers, a renewal of love. Chancellor Livingston. May 1797, New York City. I was happy. I somehow forgot that. In the blazing trail of my husband's wake, it has been easier to remember the hard times, the wars and the riots, the illnesses and exhaustion, the arguments and betrayals, the things people call history. But happiness grew in the cracks between great events. I was happy in the little things, in falling asleep beside my husband each night and waking up in his arms every morning, in walking my boys to the ferry to attend their school on Staten Island, in listening to Alexander and Anna sing duets at the piano, in the sermons at Trinity Church, where we rented a pew, and in the company of my sister Angelica, returned after more than 7.5 years of separation. Finally, it seemed I had everything I wanted. Angelica, I called, tearful with joy, waving over the workday crowd bustling along Broadway in front of her new townhouse. Upon seeing me, my sister abandoned her baggage, retinue, and children to rush into my arms. Such was the force of our embrace that her dazzling diamond earrings caught in my dark hair, and we were briefly entangled, laughing and crying at the same time. "Just look at you," Angelica exclaimed, laying both hands atop my pregnant belly. "Have you grown fat with too fond a taste for marzipan, or has my brute of a brother begotten another baby upon you?"
"Brute, am I?"
Alexander asked, archly, swooping forward in elegant top hat. Angelica nearly wilted at the sight of him. "Oh, my aimable," she cried, throwing her perfumed arms around my husband's neck. "You know I jest. But oh, how naughty you two have been." "Very naughty," I replied, for my sister always brought out my saucy side. "We do love to overindulge in marzipan." We were caught up in a gale of laughter when my sister's brood gathered around us, and I gasped at the sight of her eldest son. How in the world had the little boy who spent that frigid winter with us in Morristown grown up to be an outrageously handsome young Englishman? "Aunt Eliza, I presume," he said, with a charming, Eton-educated accent. "Oh, my darling nephew," I said, tugging my own boy close. "Meet your cousin, Philip Hamilton." Both Philips grinned, mischief in their eyes, as if already wondering which one might best the other in charming the young ladies of New York.
"My friends call me Flip," my nephew said, "so it shan't be difficult to distinguish."
Our reunion was so deliriously pleasurable that, as we stepped inside Church's grand new house, I couldn't seem to stop weeping, a thing I blamed upon pregnancy, but it had more to do, I think,